Hello, everyone. I'm Mike Simmons, the founder of Astronomy for Equity. Welcome to the Big Impact Astronomy Podcast. Today, our guest is Kelly Blumenthal. Kelly is the director of the International Astronomical Union's Office of Astronomy Outreach. It's hosted by the Astronomical Observatory of Japan in Tokyo and represented by its network of national outreach coordinators in more than 100 countries. Kelly is an astrophysicist and a science communicator from the U.S., the United States. She's lived in different communities in the U.S. and worked with many of them and with other communities around the world. And through these experiences, she's learned to understand the importance of astronomy communication in building STEM opportunities for under-resourced people worldwide and astronomy's role in science generally. So, Kelly, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, this is going to be fun because we've known each other quite a while, and I've worked with the OAO for a long time, and you guys are doing some really great work. So, to start off, I can read the mission statement on the website. I'd rather just hear it from you, you know, instead of the official language. Tell us what the OAO is for and what the goal is.
So very simply, the goal is to encourage people to be involved with science through the science of astronomy, because astronomy has this amazing ability to inspire awe and curiosity in people. And it really kind of builds the foundations for getting people excited about science, because they see all of the different ways that they can engage with astronomy, not only from a scientific perspective, but also through the humanities, through poetry, through art. And there's all these different ways that you can engage with astronomy, approach it. And so people feel as though it kind of speaks to them in a deeper way. And that kind of personalized approach, that more humanized approach, brings people into the world of STEM, which is ultimately what we hope to do. So the Office for Astronomy Outreach, we have these two main branches of what we do, really, one of which deals directly with the public through our National Outreach Coordinator Network that you mentioned, who engage in their communities worldwide. We have actually more than 120 countries that are represented. There's more than 400 people in our network in total, and they work within their communities. They reach out to the people in those communities. They also reach out to science communicators in the region, and they bring the resources and opportunities that the OAO provides and kind of cascades them out, snowballs them out into regions that otherwise wouldn't have had access to that. So we have some projects and programs that deal specifically with the public, one of which is a legacy from the International Year of Astronomy in 2009, the 100 Hours of Astronomy project that we do. This year, it is dedicated to planetariums. So we're working with the International Planetarium Society to kind of celebrate, like a final celebration of the 100 years of the planetarium. So it's very, you know, kind of symmetrical, 100 hours of astronomy for 100 years of the planetarium. And so for that, we are really encouraging planetariums worldwide to get involved with us and our projects. One of these projects is going to be a 24-hour live stream of planetariums around the world tuning in, saying hello, showing us what's going on under their dome, and you know, passing the baton on to the next planetarium wherever it winds up being around the world. So that'll be a very exciting time for us, and also exciting to see what people do in their planetarium. And I should say, this is not just for stationary planetariums. This is also for mobile planetariums, DIY planetariums, home-built planetariums, tactile planetariums. So we really want to see a true diversity of what goes on underneath any kind of dome. And even if you don't have access to one, we are going to try to bring that opportunity to people virtually. So please keep an eye out for something along those lines. So that's our public engagement branch. Our second branch is
really... Let me interrupt you and say, when will 100 Hours of Astronomy be?
Yes, of course. That'll be in October, October 2 to 5. It kind of overlaps really nicely with World Space Week. So we start off the celebration, and then World Space Week picks it up. And in the middle there is International Observe the Moon Night from NASA. So it's a really great time of engaging with astronomy and being part of a global celebration of astronomy.
Yeah, I'll point out too that the International Observe the Moon Night was also a project, a national project in the United States, started as National Observe the Moon Night. I don't remember, I was in charge of the, I led the 100 Hours of Astronomy then. I don't remember all the programs that were in it. I don't remember if that was a part of it or not. That we had maybe a million people look through telescopes in one night during the Global Star Party and other things during the day. So it's good to see that continues. But a lot of legacy projects came out of that that are big things now.
Yeah. Yeah. The International Year of Astronomy is really a seminal time for astronomy engagement and communication. A lot of really great things came out of that, including the OAO. So thank you. So just to finish, you know, kind of the overview of the OAO, we also have this branch that's dedicated to professional development, with the understanding that science communication and astronomy communication is a really integral part of the scientific process. Because if you don't get people interested in science through science communication, then you don't have scientists to, you know, continue our future of scientific endeavors, driving innovation. So science communication is really something that we need to foster. And that's what we're trying to do through our Communicating Astronomy with the Public programming. So we have this umbrella of opportunities through CAP, Communicating Astronomy with the Public, one of which is our conference. The next one is happening in Armenia, in Yerevan, in 2026, in May, I believe. And that will be a very exciting conference to be a part of. We also have our Communicating Astronomy with the Public Journal. We are building up a training program as well. And we have a community of practice, which we are still trying to build up, but eventually we'll be trying to recruit people from the public to join this community to just discuss the latest in science communication research, best practices. You know, we do try to base everything that we're doing in the science of science communication that's really evidence-based and data-driven. But of course, there's a lot to be learned from best practices and just experiential knowledge. So we try to bridge these two things together in everything that we do. And so that's the OAO.
Well, and that's a lot in the fact that you're working with amateur astronomy groups and professional astronomers. It really broadens this. I've worked in public outreach with amateur astronomers for a little over 50 years now, organizing things on a local basis and then internationally for the last 26, 27 years. And so, and we're doing very similar things in some ways. You're looking at the whole broad picture, including the scientific aspects of it. For us in Astronomy for Equity, we are also providing resources for the organizations that are already out there doing, whether it's public outreach or formal education, in the places that need it most. But we're really focused on certain specific things. I did, with a prior organization, start the international communications and things in the early days of the internet. And you guys have picked it up from there. So I guess you can tell I approve of what you're doing.
I'm glad.
It's really good. And we work together. And one of the things you mentioned having to do with professional development, which implies professional astronomers and learning to communicate better, which is really badly needed. I've been in science professionally my whole life until I retired. Now I just do this. And scientists know their field really well. And some of them just can't explain it to anybody without. I have a lot of examples of that where, you know, they answer questions with equations, and this is not the way to do it for people not in your field. So that's really important. We should discuss too. I have some ideas that I talked with a mutual colleague about best practices for amateur astronomers around the world that we'd like to, you know, maybe we should work together on that.
Yeah.
So now the CAP conference, Communicating Astronomy with the Public, is something that's been really just the most important meeting for me for a very long time.
Absolutely.
And it seemed at first that it would be maybe for the professionals, because I know I met a lot of public information officers at big observatories and things like that, but it's really broad. So this is a great conference. The last one in Toulouse, France was a good example of that. And the importance of crossing disciplines and so on is a critical one. That comes up in the CAP conference quite a bit. There's an awful lot of that. And I think in the CAP journal. So let's see. I have a bunch of pictures here of what you guys are doing. Well, of course, there's the network and different kinds of programs that you have. Here's just one of them. And this impactful astronomy outreach, really, this goes really at the core of what it is I've done with amateur astronomers forever. And this is important. This is kind of what I'm implying too. We'll have to talk about later. Things like this are critical. You've got networks, the network you have volunteers in 120 countries, and providing some simple resources and training is really kind of an important thing. Now here's an example. This one from Egypt with somebody I think I've met at one of the conferences there. What is happening here? It's a good example.
Well, so this is one example of some of the activities that our NOCs do, our National Outreach Coordinators. So this is based in Egypt. Sumaya Saad, I believe, uploaded this image into our drive. And they do a lot of work looking at the sun because they have this really amazing resource of the historical solar telescope there. That they can bring students to and, you know, teach them about the sun, teach them about sunspots, solar eclipses, and all of these different things. And, you know, when they don't have access to that, they bring them in and they do these kind of STEAM activities, you know, blending science and art together. So it's a wonderful opportunity for the students to kind of experience science in multiple different ways.
And now, so to be clear, you are not developing people in these countries or organization in these countries. You're supporting the ones that are already existing there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's just an army. I mean, a huge, just the things that you and I have both done, taking advantage of these passionate volunteers, the evangelicals of astronomy in every country. And just giving a little to many of these places makes a big difference. One place I've worked with a fair amount and been to, Ethiopia, and there is a program going on here.
Yeah, so this was a STEM development program. So this was for, you know, I think when we think about kind of trying to encourage students to go into STEM careers, often what we think about is talking to the best and brightest students. And what they're doing here is providing these opportunities and resources for everybody in the school. So, you know, it's not just for people who are already kind of on a track to pursue those kinds of careers, but it's also, you know, demonstrating that science and STEM can be accessible to anyone. It just takes being, you know, having the right resources, having the right mentorship, being able to see yourself in that role to get you to be in a space where you can engage with that. And so that's what they were trying to do in this image in a school in Ethiopia.
Yeah, it sounds like you're talking about our mission too, because it's so similar. I'm not focusing with the experience I have, learning how astronomy is used around the world, focusing on the unserved. I don't even call them underserved anymore, because of the places that don't have anything whatsoever, you know, schools, they wouldn't have a building like this. And they do that in Ethiopia, and they're a part of programs that we're doing there as well. And just providing a little bit of resources with some guidance and some mentorship goes a long way. And here's another one in Qatar. So I can't tell what's happening there because I don't read Arabic.
Well, this was actually a really great example of, you know, it's something that you said, you know, we're supporting the NOCs, we're not building capacity, but what we do through that support is help them build capacity within their own communities. And so what is happening in this, or what did happen in this activity that is represented here, is the students taught other students about the sun, and then they led a kind of engagement program after that. So they're kind of demonstrating the different things that they taught, the different things that they learned, and, you know, with the solar telescopes that they used. So, you know, when you're talking about how best to get students involved in STEM, a lot of what the research says, and a lot of what, you know, we just know implicitly, is that representation is a really important part of that, and being able to see yourself in that role. And one of the best ways to do that is through peer mentorship. And that's really what they were exemplifying in this activity.
And another point that I want to make too, that I have to make all the time, because people have said that I'm a booster of astronomy. And that's not really true. Astronomy is the gateway to these different STEM fields. Astronomy is what we use. So we're not trying to make everybody become an astronomer. But in many places, astronomy is, it's not only the most accessible science, it's sometimes the only really accessible science in places where they don't have laboratories, they don't, you know, schools may not even have, the teachers have a good education in science. A good example is last year I did a remote observing program on Las Cumbres with the astronomy club from the University of Benghazi in Libya. And I don't think any of them were astronomy majors. They're just into astronomy. And we used astronomy to have them go through a project where they got a chance to make measurements and learn how to process the data and all those things. These are things that apply to every science, and they wouldn't have the opportunity otherwise. So the way we can do it, the solar eclipse glasses that I've acquired for a new program we're getting around the world for these places, we have over 1 million. And I have to keep telling people this is not about solar eclipses. It's about looking at the sun and learning about the sun. Places where they won't have telescopes or even the internet frequently. So astronomy is the best tool there is for accessibility for most of the world. And everybody loves it. So, I mean, you can't lose. You want to go hang out in the chemistry lab, not everybody will say yes, you know. And or if you're out on the street and saying, hey, we're talking about chemistry over here, you want to learn about chemistry, you know, put out a telescope, invite people to look through a telescope. Everybody wants to do that. So good stuff. Well, here's something we were just talking about. Two things we were talking about, actually. So, this is the planetarium and the space center. I don't remember the name, but I would butcher it if I
yes.
Anyway. Okay, thank you. And the planetarium there during the CAP conference last year, and the CAP journal you're talking about here too. So that's just an example of the journal, but I think we covered that. So it's we can go on. And here are some of your NOCs, National Outreach Coordinators.
Past, future, and present.
Past, future, and present. I know about a half of them. You know, we run around in the same circles here from countries all over. Let's see. I mean, it's wonderful. I love being a part of this kind of community. We have Kosovo, Pakistan, Portugal, Senegal, Qatar, India, Vietnam. These are just a few of the people I recognize offhand. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the thing about astronomy is, we're not really crossing borders. We're just part of the planet of astronomy lovers. You know, they're just geography doesn't matter. It's the same everywhere.
It's true. Our shared sky.
Yep. And here is the conference coming up in Armenia next year, which I can't wait to go to. Now here, okay. So this is the IU General Assembly in Cape Town, and it's the same kind of a picture, but you guys cheated here. You
know? I did cheat. You're right. So we had two calls for photos, and some people showed up for one, some people showed up for the other. So instead of going through and picking out people and making sure that everybody was there once, I just combined the two and added the people that weren't there at all. So
yeah, there are a lot of faces that are clearly photoshopped in. You aren't trying to fool anybody there. Clearly, or you would have gotten somebody that could do it better, which would not be me.
And, it's true. I am not a graphic designer.
Yeah, exactly. And there are a bunch of people that are in here twice, like you.
Including myself.
It's very impressive, and we'll just let it go at that. But, you know, there are a lot of people there. And the thing is, our community, it's not just the representatives for organizations we run or something like that. It's just huge. I mean, people from every country, there are many, many more people behind all of this than you see there. So another example of a program this Women in Solar Physics. Tell us about this, predicting solar flares.
Well, so the Women in Solar Physics is a webinar series that we're doing this year in particular because of the solar maximum in 2025. It'll be at its absolute max in July, I believe. So every month this year, we are highlighting a different woman in solar physics and having her talk about her work. And we are not just doing this in English, but we're also doing this in the languages that these women speak. So, you know, if they're more comfortable talking in English, then that's great. If not, we have one recording or one, transmit these live on YouTube. And the next one will be on June 20th. So if you're interested in participating or watching that, then keep an eye out for a link from us to sign up and to watch the YouTube live. But we have one webinar that was in Japanese. We'll have another one that's in Korean. And we're, you know, looking forward to welcoming everyone to participate in these programs and participate in a way that makes the most sense for them. So this is a really exciting thing that we're doing. Hopefully we'll continue this well into the future. Maybe not all related to solar physics, but definitely related to women in astronomy and highlighting women in astronomy.
And that's something that has been a big topic, not always for good reasons, but, you know, there are a lot of issues and there's a lot of gender inequality in every country that I'm aware of. And so this is really important because we need more people to be working in these things, and women should have the opportunity just the same as men. And it's really an important thing. Somehow diversity has become controversial in some places. And I can't say what I think about that simply because somebody would have to edit it out, but it's just a bad idea to try and exclude people, I think. And I think this was a good time too to give the URL here for the website so that people can check out what you do. There's much more on the website, and sign up for the newsletter, which is really good. It comes out quite often, and learn about what it is that's going on. So when you say, sign up for notices, that there you go, IAUOutreach.org.
Yep, that's us. And
so let's see. Well, we talked about this one.
We did.
We've both been involved with this at the beginning and the latest here. And it's just a really good way of focusing. You mentioned, too, also that I think you're going to have planetariums, sort of a live stream from planetariums for 24 hours. We did the same thing in 100 Hours of Astronomy in the International Year. That was the only part I was involved in. It was such a big thing in 2009 that nobody knew how to do this. And so somebody else ran, Douglas Price Pierce at ESO ran that part of it. And I ran all the other things in engaging people directly. It was hard. It's a lot easier now. It's really wonderful. And I'm assuming that people will be able to watch the recordings of different parts of it too. So you don't have to stay up for 24 hours watching this live stream.
It's true. It'll all be streamed live on our YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. And then the recording will be available at any time.
Great. And well, here's something I care about too. One more program, Protecting Our Dark Skies. So OAO, you guys really sort of get into everything.
Yeah, we try to cover as much as possible. So this was a panel discussion talking about how to engage with policymakers for the protection of dark skies. You know, because this is another aspect of professional development that I think is really important, and that's getting communicators to understand how to work with and work alongside policymakers to really try and, you know, change the landscape of astronomy, not just astronomy, but, you know, keeping our ecosystem safe, keeping people safe. And, I should say also that protecting our dark skies is not just about eradicating all light at night, but it's about having smart and intelligent lighting that makes sense for the area. You know, if you have a really remote highway, there's no need to have lights on all the time. You can have, motion sensor streetlights that turn on when cars are coming and turn off when they're not there. So there are ways of approaching dark sky protection while also maintaining safety. And I think people maybe forget that sometimes.
Yeah, people frequently don't really get the idea that the idea is to use light responsibly. Now, I'm on the board of Dark Sky International, so I'm involved in this quite a bit. Samyukta that you have there is also on the board, and Chris is with Dark Sky also. This started as the International Dark Sky Association. And I worked with the founder, one of the founders, Dave Crawford, way back when. And they started it really based on preserving the sky for astronomy. And not everybody really understood or cared about that. But when you see the lights of a city from up above flying over, you know, I'm in Southern California, I fly into Los Angeles, just lights shining as far as you can see. You shouldn't be able to see those lights. I mean, they're shining up, and you should be able to see the lit up streets, but not the lights shining up at you. And so this is a problem all over the world. I could go on about this for hours, so I'm not going to say too much about it. But it is critically important, not only just for ecosystems, because many animals are affected by it. It's critical for people, too. We've learned that night at light is a real medical problem. It's related to cancer and all the sorts of other things you wouldn't expect, because it messes up the circadian rhythm and the hormones and things like that. So there are a lot of issues there. So International Dark Sky Week is grown and grown and grown. So
it has indeed.
Good to see that. So I didn't see this particular panel discussion, but
it's on our YouTube.
There you go. Okay, good. I can see what you guys had to say. And it's something that has really grown and needs to be more widely known. And it is. We're getting there. So I have to put in my words on that. So here's something, another program, but I recognize the glasses here. Mm-hmm. And they're from Astronomy for Equity. This is part of that sunlight program that we are just rolling out. We've sent out 130,000 of these solar eclipse glasses left over from the April 2024 eclipse here in the United States. We have over 1 million of them still, and we're developing lessons and other things to go with them. For schools like this, this is in Mozambique. Mm-hmm. And so tell me how the OAO is involved here.
Well, so this is really just through our NOC for Mozambique, bringing these solar glasses to these classrooms. And making sure that kids have the opportunity to look safely at the sun and learn about the sun. So that's really the most important thing.
Okay. So, you know, again, we are in the same circles here. And many of the NOCs are people that I know that are working with us. It's interesting when you look at the signature for a lot of these people. They've got like 10 lines of all the different organizations they represent in their country. It's the same people over and over again. We've had a couple of times we've given glasses to them, but it's all part of the same thing. And there are ways that we can support each other's programs as well. So what else is there? What's coming up? What's new?
What's new?
Professional development, for example.
Yeah, so we're working on a few things within professional development that are, I think, kind of exciting. So we're part of this collaboration that's run out of the National Science Foundation in the U.S., or it's funded by the National Science Foundation. It's called AstroExcel, and I can't tell you what the acronym stands for, but roughly it is about building connections and building bridges between practitioners and researchers in science, or really astronomy, communication, culture, education, learning, in an attempt to bring these two often like siloed regions together to improve practices in astronomy communication. You know, there's a lot that practitioners can learn from researchers in science communication, but there's really a lot that researchers can learn from practitioners, you know, namely what works practically. What do people need support on? What questions need to be answered? And how can they communicate their research in such a way that it, you know, breaches to the practitioners. I've talked to a lot of educators who say that, you know, there's a lot of really great education research that's going on, but they don't have access. You know, often the journals are behind a paywall, or they're written in such a way that it's just impossible to understand, and they don't see how they can apply the work that's been done, the research that's been done to their classroom. And that's true, you know, across the board when it comes to these communication research practices. And so what we're trying to do is improve that connection, improve that relationship, and make it easier for these two communities to really talk to each other and learn from each other.
So, and it's definitely true that the more scientific you get, the more inaccessible results are. And this is not necessarily a bad thing, because you have to, and as a retired researcher myself, you have to use the terminology that communicates with other people in your field. And you have to do things in kind of standardized ways, too, to make sure that you're communicating properly. But then it can't get out from the ivory tower that way. It just doesn't work. So when you say practitioners, so first we're talking about research in astronomy communication, and the practitioners are teachers?
They could be teachers, but you know, more often than not, when we're talking about astronomy communication, we're not really talking about education. We're not talking about formal education. We're talking about informal, non-formal education. So, you know, there is a pretty big distinction. I know a lot of people kind of think it's very fuzzy, but there are similarities, certainly. But the way that things are taught and the way that information is disseminated and really absorbed by the learner, whether they be, you know, students, children, or adult learners, is very different. So we're really talking about informal communication or informal education. So that could be, you know, people that work in museums, people that work in libraries who are trying to bring educational programs to the people that frequent that library. They could be astronomy communicators like our NOX, who are running these programs. They could be amateur astronomers or citizen scientists, people who participate in science activities in general. So there's, you know, really like a broad range of people that we could be talking about when we say practitioners. And, you know, that itself is a challenge, because, you know, it's typically best to have an audience that's very well defined, that you can target everything that you're trying to do toward them, so you know that you're providing the best service for that target group. But you know, this is a very lofty project, and what we're hoping is that with each piece of Astro Excel, we will be able to target very specific groups and work with them more, maybe not individually, but you know, in a more focused way.
Yeah. So, you know, in my universe is amateur astronomers around the world, and they're everywhere. And of course, your NOX are mostly amateur astronomers, really. Some of them are not getting out there with their telescopes, but a lot of the people I recognize in the photos do that. And I think that there are far more amateur astronomers doing sidewalk astronomy, communicating astronomy, than there are professionals and in libraries and things like that. And that's a real challenge too, something else we should talk about, because I have ideas about everything. And I've seen amateur astronomers do a questionable job about communicating things to the public, and very simple. People love to do it, but not everybody's good at it. Usually the people that love doing something are naturally quite good at it or become good at it. It's not always the case. So there's a lot of work to do there. I mean, you just got tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people to reach with this kind of a thing. So that's really kind of critical. So when the OAO started, Si Lung was the director, and I wasn't real clear on what the office was going to do. It was going to focus here, going to focus there. I think it took a while for the office to decide what its mission really should be. Usually that involves narrowing things down. You guys went the other way.
Yeah, we did.
Really broadened it out, but you're doing a lot, and that's really important. Hopefully that will continue to grow and to find different ways to do things, and maybe you'll get a chance to narrow the field a little bit at some point. But hopefully you'll get the funding and everything you need to do more.
Yes.
I want to leave from the office here and ask you, because I don't even really know. I know your background in general, but you did a lot of things in the U.S.
I did.
You're in Tokyo now. Tell us about how you came to this. I gave a short little bio there that doesn't really say a whole lot. Where are you from and how did you get started in astronomy? You have a PhD in astronomy, and a lot of times I've known a lot of students over the years who went through grad school and got their PhDs and said, I don't really want to do research. I really want to talk to people about it and switch. There's a lot of that that goes on during that time. Tell us your story.
Okay. I think my story will sound very familiar to a lot of women who hear it. And so I am from New Jersey. I grew up loving astronomy. For me, astronomy was always something that was very, relaxing isn't quite the right word. It was very like, it helped me understand my place and reminded me of, you know, not only how small the Earth is and how small I was on the Earth, but also like how amazing it is that I can think about that. And I know that that's a trope that like is talked about all the time. But for me as a child, this was always something that I came back to. And it really, you know, like helped me, you know, if there was ever any thing that I was stressed out about or anxious about or anything, I would think about that. And it's like, okay, Jupiter's really big. The Earth is really small. It's all going to be okay. Because Jupiter is what I could see out my window usually. And my dad was really into astronomy. He, you know, we got a telescope and we lived between Newark and New York. And so it was really difficult to see the sky at any given point throughout the year. You know, I maybe could recognize like Orion in the winter when it was up, but we would, you know, try to go see meteor showers. And we'd look at the moon and, you know, it was really, I always was fascinated by it. And when I was a kid, I remember at like 12 or something, I told my dad I wanted to study galaxy evolution. Not quite understanding precisely what that was, but I thought it was really cool. And, you know, he took me to the Northeastern Astronomy Forum. I don't know if you or anybody who's listening is familiar with that, but we went quite a few times.
Yeah.
And it was a really wonderful opportunity for me to see all of the like different things that are going on in astronomy. And, you know, it's just like a collection of amateur astronomers that were getting together. And one of, you know, so I was really interested in science and astronomy in high school, but I was also doing music and art, and I was really excited about all of these things. And I wasn't sure how I could possibly combine them into one thing. So at one of these Northeastern Astronomy Forum meetings, a professor from Boston University was giving a talk and then pulled out a guitar and started playing some songs that he had written about blazars. And I was just so enamored with this. And I, you know, afterward, I had a conversation with him and I said, you know, I'm really excited about astronomy. I really love music. I love that you do both of these things in your life. And he said, you know, if you go to BU, then you have a job with me. So I went to Boston University. I started working with him and his research group basically as soon as I got there. And I was able to major in astronomy and physics in the College of Arts and Sciences and in saxophone performance in the College of Fine Arts. And I was doing both of these at the same time, which was enormously difficult. And I wound up, you know, I spent 3 years doing my music degree and I wound up leaving that so I could focus on astronomy and physics, and wound up going to the University of Hawaii for my PhD, which was a really wonderful experience. Being there was one of the best things I think I could have done for myself personally. The things that I learned, the education, not just the astronomy education, the like life education, the things that you learn and understand from working with these communities is more valuable than anything.
That's what college is really for.
Well, this was grad school. I missed this in college. I got it in grad school. But working with communities in grad school was with communities in Hawaii in particular. I learned so much from them. And was doing research in galaxy evolution, as I promised myself I would be, and had a lot of trouble with the first advisor that I had. And made it very difficult for me to want to continue doing what I was doing, even though it was something that I was extremely passionate about, that I had been passionate about for many, many years. You know, when I got to grad school, I was convinced that I was going to be, you know, like a professor in an R1 institution, doing research, taking on students, building a research group. And that's all I wanted to do. But I had such a terrible time with this person that he actually inadvertently is responsible for me where I am today. Because the way that I dealt with the stress and just immense weight of working with this person was by doing public engagement work. And I found a lot of solace, not just solace, but like it was very freeing working with these communities and really getting to know people and seeing the impact that, you know, having access to resources made in these communities and having access to knowledge really put things into a much broader perspective for me. So I finished my PhD working with an advisor who was just like the most delightful person on the planet. And extremely supportive of me and everything that I wanted to do. But I actually wound up, you know, I had kind of like a bifurcation point at the end of my PhD. I could go and I could do a postdoc, or I could go and get a master's degree in education. And it took a while to figure out precisely what I wanted to be doing with myself. But I ultimately decided to get my master's degree in education, from the Graduate School of Education at Harvard, which was a really great opportunity for me, not because it's Harvard, but because the community of people at the education school is so unlike anything that you could, any like stereotypical Harvard image that you have in your head is the like exact opposite of all the people at the ed school. They are just such a wonderful, they build a wonderful environment for education to flourish. So you can really take what you're learning in the school practically and educationally into whatever it is you want to be doing in your own practice. So it was just like an incredible opportunity that I had. And I'm so grateful that I was selected to be part of that community. But from there, I was doing a lot of work with, or while I was there, I should say, I was doing a lot of work with the Center for Astrophysics Science Education Department, and working on some curriculum development with them, doing some work also in mentoring and building like equitable spaces within academia at Harvard Smithsonian, which was also a really wonderful opportunity, and wound up working on these projects. Eventually, I think I had met Lena Canas at the 2018 CAP conference. So this was before I graduated my PhD, but I was doing a lot of work in Hawaii in public engagement. And so I was presenting on that work at CAP. And at CAP, I was floored by how many people there were doing public engagement. I thought, you know, it was just like a couple people and nobody was really into it, because that was my experience in grad school. You know, it was not really something that was valued. But when I came into this international community of astronomy communicators, I just became completely enamored with it. And so I met Lena there, who was the director before me, and she took me on as a outreach researcher, which is how I got involved with the IAU. I eventually, you know, I did a lot of work looking at the cultural implications on science communication by researching the NOCs. And that was a really cool opportunity, not only for me to get familiar with the NOCs network, but also for me to learn from them and the things that they do and how they do them. And then I wound up working with Pedro Russo at Leiden University on a project that developed a project in collaboration with the Kavli Institute, or the Kavli Foundation, I should say. And that was building public engagement training for astronomers, which was a really wonderful opportunity. I did a lot of research for that in focus groups and trying to understand what was needed by the community, and wound up focusing on relationship building, which I think is, you know, when you talk about understanding your audience, there's nothing better than embedding yourself within the community to really understand precisely what people need, how best to communicate with them. So from there, I then applied to be the deputy director of the Office for Astronomy Outreach, was selected for that, and then eventually became the director when Lena left. So here we are.
Yeah, first of all, I have to apologize for catching you off guard there, because it was just a throw. We didn't talk about putting you on the spot and talking about your whole background. And I didn't know the whole story. So I thought, well, we'll just see, you know, how do people get into this? You touched on a very big issue in astronomy, and it seems astronomy in particular, I'm not sure why that is, not just all of academia. But we talked about a little bit about gender equality in places around the world. And it is a big issue. And people, if anybody wants to know what the story is behind a lot of what's going on here, it's easy enough to find it online. We're not going to talk about it here. We don't need to do that. But it is a very big problem. And that's these are life experiences. And one of the things is that when I'm talking to students around the world in different places, either online or in person, and they're always unsure about their future and should I do this or should I do that? One of the things that I've learned is that you can make all the plans you want, but you don't know what's going to happen. You're probably not going to follow those plans.
Yeah. It's just
because you learn new things. Hopefully it's because you learn about something you love more. Sometimes it's because it turns out to be a problem in some way. Mm-hmm. It's really unfortunate, but it's part of growing up, you know, and that continues the rest of your life. Some people would say, I'm not always a real grown up. So, and so it just continues. You learn all the time. So this is a really good example. And I'm glad you shared that. I didn't intend for you to go into the details that much, but
I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. But that's okay, because it's a really good story that does inform. In a lot of ways, it is familiar, as you say, but it's a really good demonstration of that. So I appreciate your going ahead and sharing it with us. But again, I'm sorry I put you on the spot in a way too.
Okay, not to worry. I think also, you know, what my story also demonstrates is that a lot of the success you have is like luck.
Yep.
And not being afraid to like cold call somebody and say, hey, I don't know what I'm doing. Can you help me? I did a lot of that. I applied to like 30 different jobs before I got the one that, you know, where I am right now. And I couldn't be happier than where I am right now. I love what I'm doing. It's the absolute perfect thing for me.
So it's there's a happy ending off. Well, it's not the ending. This is not the last thing you'll ever do. But so far, for that journey so far, it's a happy ending. And it's absolutely true. There's a certain amount of luck. I've done a lot of things, gone to a lot of places. You talked earlier about the mental issues and, you know, just emotional things and how astronomy can be part of finding some freedom and peace. And I was in Ukraine last year with the astronomy students and providing telescopes, because their skies go dark when their power gets knocked out, you know, and that's really finding a silver lining. And it is a very, very important thing. And we both know people who work in that in countries in crisis in different ways. And so it's these are sort of common things, but you don't know what you don't know. And, mm-hmm. and you don't know anything about the future. All-star pitcher and coach for the New York Yankees, Yogi Berra, who has a cartoon named after him, was famous for making these statements. And he said, things are hard to predict, especially the future. Well, it's true.
That is true.
But this is the most important thing, I think, is to not stress about it. And to you not only make cold calls, if you don't call, you're not going to get a positive answer.
True.
And things in my life, how I end up in places, it's just because every time, you know, opportunity knocks on the door, I open it up and check it out. You never know what's going to happen. So that's was not necessarily the topic here tonight, but your story is about you. It's not just about the office. And that's a really good story. So I appreciate that. So Kelly, I appreciate your coming on and sharing the things you weren't prepared to, and that. And so, you know, I just want to thank you for joining us here, and I wish you all the best for the office. I hope it continues to expand and grow, because there's so much to do. I mean, yes. There, out of 7 billion people on the planet, there are probably about 7 billion people interested in astronomy and use of it. So we've got a lot of work.
Indeed we do. And that's the goal. That's the hope.
Yeah. We just
thank you so much.
Thank you, Kelly.
Yeah.